It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
The problem with conclusions that claim to know the lessons of history is that history teaches so many different lessons. It is next to impossible to know which to apply to contemporary events about which perception and knowledge are necessarily thickly veiled. One is therefore as likely as not to apply the wrong lessons from history while making entirely original mistakes. That said, the main lessons to be drawn from this survey are ancient yet fundamental. First, beware the vanity of nations and the hubris of leaders, civilian and military, but perhaps civilian most of all. There is grave danger to youth forced into uniform by the hurried ambitions of old men who never wore one, never smelled cordite wafting overhead or knelt by a dying comrade. Also from those who did, but who lost the wars of their youth and grew grim and determined to try again. There is nothing particularly original in those observations, except to say that vanity is original with each generation that makes war. Second, always be deeply skeptical of short war plans and promises of easy victory, for they shall surely go awry as combat commences and descends into chaos, and an intelligent and determined enemy refuses to accept the initial verdict. Let us be rid as well of all claims to genius of the greatest generals, and of the whole idea of genius in war, whether of the fawning nationalist sort or Clausewitz's more refined version. It is no more than a form of armchair idolatry, divorced from real explanation of preparation and supporting resources and skill, which then meets with chance in battle. Claims to genius distance our understanding from war's immense complexity and contingency, which are its greater truths. The best field captains react better and more quickly to war's essential confusion, the fog of war, than others, but no one truly commands or ever controls such a complex and dynamic thing as battle, let alone war. Assertion of genius separates us from war's wider and shared character, and from its suffering. It upholds the imagined heroic over the brutally horrific, however just the cause and necessary the war may be or might have been. Its celebration by national partisans and historians, who are too often one and the same, obscures the stumbling even of the greatest generals and the grim endurance of soldiers. Let us be done with all that, with talk and poses and lies about genius in war. CJ here, welcome to episode 182 of the Dangerous History Podcast. And in this episode, I'm going to be speaking with the author of the book from which that passage I just shared with you was extracted. It's one of my favorite passages. It's in the conclusion of the book, the title of which is The Allure of Battle, A History of How Wars Have Been Won and Lost. And its author is Professor Cattle J. Nolan. Professor Nolan is an associate professor of history at Boston University and is the executive director of the International History Institute. He holds a BA degree from the University of Alberta and an MA and PhD degree from the University of Toronto. His latest nonfiction book, which we're going to be talking about in this episode, is The Allure of Battle, which was published by Oxford University Press in 2017 and which received the very prestigious Gilder Lehrman Prize for Military History. I will, of course, have links to this book in the show notes, as well as some of Professor Nolan's other books as well. So now I present to you my recent conversation with Cattle Nolan.
Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care, and we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Professor Nolan, thank you for taking the time to talk with me on the Dangerous History Podcast today.
Oh, you're very welcome.
So I'm primarily going to talk with you about your most recent book. I guess it was published a couple of years ago, The Allure of Battle, A History of How Wars Have Been Won and Lost, which won the Gilder Lehrman Prize for Military History, which is a pretty prestigious award. And the first thing I want to ask you, I just have to ask, how many years went into this book? Because it's quite a piece of work.
Well, writing the book, the actual writing of the book, took 2 years. Researching it sort of directly was about 5 years. But in a way, it's a culmination of everything I've been thinking through my teaching primarily over the last 25 years or so. But I didn't work on it for 25 years. I mean, I worked on it for five, and the last two was the actual writing.
Oh, okay. So let's kind of start off in broad strokes. What is the allure of battle? What do you mean by the allure of battle?
Well, another way, by that phrase, and it's kind of deliberately got a semi-sexual connotation, what I mean is people are seduced into war by the allure of the idea that the war will be short and decisive, even when they know they are the weaker party. In fact, the pattern seems to be that especially when they know they are the weaker party, they turn to the idea that we can win a short war. So if you prefer a different phrase, short war delusion would be a substitute for the allure of battle. We can win a short war. We can win it in the opening campaign. We can win it in the opening battle even. The 19th century had the idea of a single decisive battle. 20th century changed that into decisive campaign, but still opening. We're talking months, not years. And the idea is that the weaker power is terribly afraid of getting dragged into, falling into a war of attrition. It'll do anything to avoid a war of attrition, except give up the idea of war, which it is likely to lose, knows it's likely to lose if it goes long. So it's all or nothing. It's a gambler's mentality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it seems like, and various parts of the book speak about, and it definitely strikes me that there's also the cult of battle, kind of within the historiography itself, going all the way back, as you indicate early on in the book, to ancient times. That I guess because so many historians and military theorists and so forth. Battle is, as you kind of indicated before, battle is sexy, right? So
yeah.
All of the, you know, ancient through modern writers on military topics seem to be fixated on it. And this kind of creates almost in a way kind of like a self-licking ice cream cone or a self-fulfilling prophecy. I'm not sure quite the right metaphor, but where because there's all this emphasis in the writings on war, on battle, then that often seems to tend to make future generals, you know, their military
yeah.
education and all this also focuses on battle as the most important thing. So could you comment a little bit on that, on
sure.
how kind of the historiography and the military theory and kind of how your book here is turning a lot of that on its head?
Well, I thought I was going to get into all kinds of trouble when I wrote this book, frankly, because it does really, in a sense, poke its finger into so many different, you know, eyes of of the profession and the approach of the profession. The standard approach of the profession is that wars are decisive moments in history, and inside wars, the decisive turning points are key battles. So, for instance, I think the way to sort of get rid of this right off the top is just to ask people, what was the decisive battle of the Second World War? And you'll usually hear them trot out the same names. Now, if you want to say Midway, you can make a case for it, but it's not decisive in the sense it defeated Japan. It certainly was a turning point. I'm not saying that battles don't matter. I'm not saying that they aren't turning points. I'm saying that in modern wars, and as an historian, modern to me means about the last 300 years or so, in modern wars among the major powers, the idea that you can win in a sort of a roll of the iron dice of war, as Bismarck called them, that you can win in an afternoon or you can win in a summer's campaign, history is just against that. It shows that that is not the case. And the Second World War, so I think the one that people would say, if you just ask the question off the top, they'll say Stalingrad. And my argument is that something like Stalingrad or Kursk or all of these are major battles, these are important battles. But World War II was won by mass slaughter and a slow grinding of attrition over 6 years. And that means that what Stalingrad really did was accelerate the rate of attrition. It helped additionally wear down the German forces. But it was not decisive in the sense of it determined. If we're going to use the term decisive to mean it decided the war, it didn't do it. Mm. It accelerated the attrition that decided the war. And I think that is the pattern of most of the wars. The Napoleonic Wars is the one that I think has really distorted the perception of historians. I mean, Napoleon, Clausewitz himself actually referred to Napoleon as, and I quote, the god of war. That's preposterous. But it's Clausewitz. So people read Clausewitz the way they read the Bible. They find what they want in there. They quote it. They hardly ever read the whole book. And if they did, they would find out that Clausewitz is itself, the book on war is itself profoundly conflicted. There's a first half and a second half. And then the second half, he kind of says, what I wrote when I was younger, the first half is wrong. But everybody really quotes the first half. It's a problem. It's a problem.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, when I was reading this book, because I'm not primarily a military historian, but I'm kind of like I dabble in it. You know, I'm an interested party in it. And one of the experiences I had when reading The Allure of Battle was the experience of reading things articulated better than I had ever articulated them, either out loud or in my mind. And by someone who's much more of an expert specifically in the field, but things that I had for many years kind of thought in a more kind of fuzzy, less formed sort of a way, these sorts of thoughts that, you know, it's not at all clear that winning battles automatically translates to winning wars. And it has always struck me ever since I got into history at all, how often the commanders, the generals who are supposedly the great geniuses of war, how often, if you look at the big picture, they end up losing, some of them spectacularly, the very least not achieving all of their aims. And so I can remember when I was a student, often getting into arguments with a buddy of mine who was a big fan of Napoleon. And, you know, all I kept saying was, yeah, but
he lost.
And the same thing is true of
twice.
Yeah.
He lost twice.
Yeah. Yeah. So
he was forced to abdicate twice. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, could you comment on maybe a little bit more on Napoleon in that regard? And some of the other figures that you cover in this book who have this reputation for being these absolute geniuses of war, but when you actually look at their career, it ended in loss.
Well, that's an argument that I think the one that I'm most proud is not the word. The argument I think is most important in the book that I make is that we need to disabuse ourselves of this whole idea of genius in war, in particular in modern war. The search for genius, and we do it in different ways. We look for individual geniuses in battlefield commanders, and we find them in history, and we identify them. And so, I'm saying military historians do this. And I think if you're looking for genius in modern warfare, and you're not going to like this, it's actually in the capacity of modern society to organize millions of people over long periods of time. It's actually bureaucracy. It's the capacity to put people in uniform, to feed them, to sustain them, to arm them. Because how wars are won, even if you don't set out this way to win them, you set out to win them through battle, you set out to win them through campaigns, you set out to win them through superior technology, and you find that if you're up against a more or less equal power over time, you're going to get ground down and you have to grind his armies down and his navies down as well. So it comes down to, well, how many men can we put in uniform? How many guns can we make? How many tanks can we produce? I think the spectacular example of this problem in the 20th century is Germany, in both the First World War and in the Second World War. Just to give you one example, I mean, by the end of World War II, most people, I think, know this. Most of your listeners probably know this. By the end of World War II, the Germans, Hitler in particular, but the Germans more generally, the German generals certainly, have this battle-centric focus. We'll win it on the next battle. We'll win it in the next campaign. Just let us get back to the magic of the panzers. And then you look at the statistics. Over the course of the Second World War, I mean, and I know that people like to sit around and compare tanks. I don't do that kind of thing. But if you want to do that, all right, let's just give for the sake of argument that the Tigers were the best individual tank of the Second World War. Okay, massive, powerful, so forth. They built 2,000 of them, just north of 2,000 of them. The Americans built 50,000 Shermans. The Soviets built 80,000 T-34s. It's just overwhelming. That's what happened. At the end of the day, you were swarming Tigers in position, plus you had aircraft superiority and so on and so forth, and the Germans were eroded, and the last 6 months or so of the war, the German army couldn't even move. It's in place, it's fixed in place, and it's destroyed completely, both on the Eastern Front and on the Western Front. But that's not Napoleon, is it? You wanted me to talk about Napoleon.
Well, yeah, a little on him, too, because I think he's probably, other than the Germans in the 20th century, he's probably the most dramatic example of this.
Well, sure. I mean, look, there's just no question. There's no question that Napoleon was a superior general, the greatest general of his era, maybe of, you know, the past several centuries. Superior. He had a natural talent for war. He had a studied talent for war. He was better at battle. You wanted to be very careful if he went up against him. You wanted to have superiority of numbers. You wanted to have superiority of position. You needed to know his tactics. He was dexterous. He had flair. But by the end of it, by the end of the fighting, which went on for 23 years, the French Revolutionary and Napoleonic Wars. By the end of it, everybody knew his tactics. Everybody else had, to the extent that it was possible, given their more conservative societies, adopted French Revolutionary-style mass armies. They had moved away from the professional armies. And you ended up with great grinding battles. The so-called Battle of the Nation of Leipzig in 1813 saw 450,000 men in a three-day battle. It's Napoleon lost because he was in the last, after he made the mistake of going into Russia, where the Russians deliberately, consciously decided to avoid battle because they knew he was seeking it and that they would beat him by attrition. He was never again had the numerical advantage. His troops were worn out. France was worn out by war, and he lost and was forced to abdicate in 1814. Came back for a spectacular 100 days. And then we all get everybody, most written about battle in history is Waterloo, even more than Gettysburg. Waterloo is most written about battle in history. And it's really kind of a heroic anachronism. It didn't matter. Even if he had won at Waterloo, he was going to lose. There were five other armies with 500,000 men marching toward France to have done with this man. The nations were aroused, the nations were in arms, and they were going to get rid of him, whether he won or not.
Yeah, and as you point out in your coverage of Napoleon, he may have often shown genius in tactics, although even there he did drop the ball badly from time to time, but he seemed to be pretty clueless when it comes to overall strategy, particularly grand strategy, and at least a fair amount of the time pretty clueless on logistics as well.
Oh, yeah. This is an amazing thing. For a man who famously said an army marches on its stomach, and understood logistics in Western Europe, where there's very short distances, a huge road and canal network. You can move things around the countries of the Netherlands and the Rhineland and France and so forth very easily over short distances. You can break up your army, as Napoleon famously did, into discrete marching corps and then reconcentrate it at the moment of battle. You can do all of that. And when he got to Poland, when he got to Russia, when he got to these vast expanses with very few roads and very poor farms, for the most part, he couldn't do it. He takes in 500,000 men. You can't be as dexterous with 500,000 men as you can be with 50,000. And the wars are expanding. The nations are aroused. The nations are arming, mass armies. It's the trend that will continue through the 19th century into the 20th century, where we culminate in armies not of 500,000, but of millions. And in the Second World War, armies of literally tens of millions. These are not dexterous instruments. This is blunt force trauma. This is war as the inevitable mass clash, and grinding rather than genius is what decides it. That's my argument. I mean, I'm sure I can be challenged on many details. I'm sure of that. And there are generals who are better than others? Do generals make things better or worse? Yes, of course. But even if a general wins you a battle, the battle is not likely to win you the war. You've got to win the battle. You've got to win the summer. You've got to win the year. Then you have to win the decade. It goes on and on and on. We have wars with names like 80 Years' War, 100 Years' War, 30 Years' War. When I was speaking to active duty American officers at Fort Leavenworth in 2017, some of the people who are redrafting the, you know, Army doctrine, I don't know really why they wanted to talk to me. I was much more impressed with them, obviously. But I asked them at one point, I was maybe too cocky and feeling a bit cheeky, and I asked them in a public forum, there's a room of about 50 or so of these senior officers, whether or not they would accept that we were already in a 30 years war. They didn't bat an eye. So I said, what about a 100 years war? There were some nodding heads. They know we're in a war of attrition. They know that we're in a long contest. What are the battles of the Thunder Run in Baghdad? Is that the one? It wasn't even a battle. It was a blitzkrieg strike by the U.S. Army. What are the battles in Afghanistan? It's not. It's grinding, slow, attritional warfare. And the little guy will adapt, and they have adapted, and they're doing pretty well against the forces of the Western countries.
Mm. So can you, you've spoken a bit in our conversation so far about Napoleon, and you've spoken a bit about the Germans in the 20th century. I'm wondering if you could elaborate a little bit on the in-between, in particular, the German wars of unification and the way in which it seems that the Prussian leaders kind of saw what they wanted to see in Napoleon's, you know, in the history of Napoleon's wars, and that then their at least apparent success with quote unquote short wars in the wars of German unification kind of put the German leadership on the path that sort of led it into what happened in the 20th
right.
century.
Right. Well, I mean, the Germans were occupied in 1806. Berlin was occupied by the French. Prussian army was smashed. Berlin was occupied. Berlin was humiliated. They came back to fight the French in 1813, and they were part of the victorious coalition in 1814 and 1815 against Napoleon. But it was the Prussians more than the French who studied Napoleon and thought, this is the way to fight war. It's not actually so much Clausewitz's influence. He's a later influence, but of von Moltke, the chief of the Prussian Great General Staff, Helmut von Moltke, and other Germans, but he was the critical student, designed the Prussian army for a short, sharp war. But this is also a kind of German style in war, and it comes from the central location of Germany and the fact that if you're German, I mean, anyone's ever played Risk or diplomacy, if you ever played Risk and if you play the German position, your first instinct is to attack somebody because you have this need to secure at least one border because you do feel surrounded. The Germans used to refer to it as a ring of steel, that they felt surrounded and hemmed in their ambition to be a major power. And the way they sought to break out of this was a short, sharp, decisive war in which they isolated, and they did it successfully. I mean, they did it. They have the three wars of German unification. The first one doesn't really matter. It was a little tiny war against Denmark, and it took a small province. The big ones that counted were in 1866, the Austro-Prussian War, which was over in 7 weeks. The Prussians moved down using the new railways. The Austrians came out in a single massed army. There was a single battle. This is one of the rare decisive battles that actually decides a war in the modern period. So there are exceptions. I'm not talking about Newtonian rules of history here. The Battle of Königgrätz, or Sedan, as the French call it. In a single afternoon, the Austrian army was smashed. It was incompetently led. It had its back against the river. But it was a close-run affair. I mean, it could have actually gone another way, as almost any battle can. The Prussians won, the Austrians were smashed, and this established Prussia as dominant in northern Germany. Within 4 years, this is, by the way, of course, the American Civil War has just ended the year before. Within 4 years, the Prussians, with the same idea, isolate France diplomatically. That's the key. The British are distracted. The Russians are distracted. The Austrians have been defeated. They isolate France diplomatically. They lure France under an incompetent ruler, Napoleon III, the nephew of Napoleon I, into battle. And then they destroy the French army, though not the way they intended. They were hoping for a battle of encirclement, a complete decisive victory on the frontiers. Instead, they get several battles and then 6 months of guerrilla warfare and so on. But in the end, they win. And everybody in Europe forgets the lessons of the Crimean War that preceded the German wars and forgets the lessons. In fact, they dismiss any lessons to be learned from the American Civil War. Now, with our perspective, we look back and we say the trenches and the sieges of Crimea, the trenches and the sieges and the grinding attritional war of the American Civil War, that's a portent of what's to come. But that's not the conclusion they drew. Everyone in Europe said, look what the Germans did. Bang, bang. Prussia defeated, a great power defeated in 7 weeks. France defeated in 7 months. That's the new nature of war, and everybody prepared for that. So, and the Germans, in particular, thought we now have unlocked the secret. We have the philosopher's stone. We have the alchemist's stone that can convert decisive battle into decisive victory and world power, world dominance, not world dominance, but world power, Weltmacht, they called it, to be a world power or a great power. And they put all of that into the great gamble of 1914. I mean, as you know, I mean, this preposterous notion that they will defeat France, a great power, major army, in 45 days, then swing around on the railways and defeat another great power in Russia over the following months. And, of course, they fail to defeat the French at the Battle of the Marne in September of 1914. That failure leads directly to the existence of trenches within a couple of months, and then the War of Attrition goes on for 4 years. And they lose.
Yeah, and they don't learn the right lessons, and they do it all over again.
Yeah. They do it all over again. I mean, they defeat Poland in 1939 because it's a minor power, and it seems to confirm their short war blitzkrieg tactics. They defeat France in 1940, and that's more a matter of luck than skill. That's kind of was often referred to as a strange defeat or strange victory. I think that's right. So they defeat Poland because it's a minor power. They defeat France because they get lucky. Then they try it again against Russia, and I think they get what they deserve.
So what do you make of the way that war has gone since World War II and the degree to which, you know, direct wars between great powers seem to be simply not happening? Proxy wars.
Yeah, I think that's a big other. We have the idea of great power wars in the whole trend of military history for about 300, 400 years culminated in the great wars of World War I and World War II, in these mass armies of millions and even ultimately tens of millions of men clashing and smashing with all the weapons of an industry and science at their disposal. And we can't do it anymore because the new just tactical nuclear weapons and even tactical air power means you can't concentrate armies in that way. So you've lost the need for a mass army. And so the search has been on in the technologically advanced countries for techno fixes to the problem of to this problem. So, I mean, all through the Cold War, the United States and NATO refused to give up the idea of first use nuclear weapons because if the Warsaw Pact came through, you know, the Fulda Gap with masses of Soviet and Warsaw Pact troops, the NATO policy was to nuke them. And you just can't concentrate these forces. And we have what Churchill once referred to, not the balance of power anymore, but the balance of terror, the nuclear deterrence among the major powers. And they have, and I think you correctly noted, they have resorted to war by proxy. But these wars show the same characteristic. So in Vietnam, the Soviet Union was determined to fight the United States to the last Vietnamese and provide to them. So you're facing a fourth world country, a peasant nation with no industrial capacity, no targets you can really bomb. So the bombing target list is done within 6 months. And they keep, we keep bombing uselessly and extremely expensively, both in terms of morality and propaganda and targeting. But the Vietnamese keep on coming. And the United States kind of got payback in Afghanistan by supporting the Mujahideen against the Soviets until they lost a grinding war of attrition. Millions of people died. 3 million died in the Indochinese War. Probably 1 million died in the Soviet-Afghan War. It's not clear. These are wars of attrition by proxy, but they're still wars of attrition.
What are some of the other leading stars of history that have this reputation as these geniuses for war, you know, based on the alleged decisiveness of battle, whom we've not mentioned yet? So there's,
well, Marlborough. I mean, one of the problems I developed, you sort of asked me right at the beginning, talk about the historiography. One of the things that I encountered, which disappointed me a lot, doing a book that's this wide ranging. So I'm reading, you know, multiple histories from multiple different nations about their wars, their countries, and so on. And it was so disappointing to discover how many military historians are nationalist partisans, that they're not actually writing the history of the war. So we get all kinds of, I mean, you expect it at the popular level, but even at the sort of fairly advanced level, you're getting this "my general's better than your general" stuff. And comparative generalship, which is a parlor game that I think, I mean, students ask me all the time, well, who was better, Patton or Montgomery? How do I know? Be honest, how do I know? I've never commanded 1 million men in battle. I have no idea whether Lee should have gone left or right. I mean, you really have to be a professional officer with those kind of skills. And even then, we're just, you know, after the fact guessing. I think it's a waste of time. That's not how wars are decided, whether or not somebody went left or right in a single moment, at a critical moment of a critical battle, in a critical afternoon. I just don't think that's how modern wars are decided. So the British, for instance, Marlborough is the greatest English general anyway. One of the people behind that is Marlborough himself was a propagandist for himself at the time. And he is Marlborough is his title name. His original name was John Churchill. So you can imagine his family, and particularly one descendant, wrote a 2- or 3-volume biography of Marlborough and plays him up as a great general. Almost all the British military historians hold up Marlborough as this great decisive general. He fought 4 battles. He lost one, the last one, and it was such a bloodbath that the Dutch, he was a joint commander of Dutch and English forces, the Dutch fired him and then the English fired him. It was mass slaughter. Did he have talent that was superior to other people? Yes, but most of his career was spent at the time fighting sieges and marching without engaging the enemy, because the enemy would avoid battle and so forth. Battles were fairly rare until we get to Napoleon. Frederick the Great is the other one that's always cited.
So what's the common conception or depiction of Frederick the Great versus the more kind of cold hard truth?
Well, Frederick, the depiction of Frederick the Great is that, again, all of these generals are seen as innovators, tactical innovators, and that's the problem. You said this also earlier, that's where it stops. They were tactical innovators. I'm not taking that away. Marlborough was an innovator. He did many things that we would regard as brilliant. Frederick the Great was a tactical innovator. The problem was he came up with one tactic he used over and over and over. I won't go into details. It's called the oblique order, where he would attack against one flank by marching his troops across the battlefield under concealment. He did it repeatedly until people knew he was doing this, and they were able to counter it. But the military histories treat Frederick as this incredible innovator, this brilliant, brilliant mind on horseback, which culminates ultimately in Napoleon. And I think it's an intellectual fetishism, by intellectuals who are writing military history. The end of the day, Frederick was actually saved from Prussia being invaded. He was actually contemplating suicide. He was on the verge of such a catastrophic defeat when a sheer accident of history saved him. Frederick was infamously agnostic, possibly atheist, but But he even referred to this as the miracle of the House of Brandenburg. And what he meant by that was there was a death. The Russian army was marching into Prussia. And the Tsar died, or the Tsarina died, rather, and was replaced by this young 20-something Tsar who greatly admired Frederick and recalled the army. And that was it. That's what saved Prussia. Not his brilliance, not his battlefield technique, not his tactical or operational dexterity. It was an accident of history. And history is full of things like that, that the modern mind balks against, because we want to say A plus B plus C equaled victory. And we want to, historians are, I think, almost congenitally disposed toward causal chains. But history is full of accident and sidestepping and backward movement, and it's more chaotic than it is controlled, I think. And that's why I think the idea of genius and control of something as complicated as battle, let alone war, is misplaced and misdirects us from the true, I think, deeper realities of modern warfare, which is they are won by endurance, they are chaotic, no one is actually in control, and they become struggles. The analogy I used, you probably encountered it a couple of times, is like sumo wrestlers struggling until one finally drops from exhaustion, usually just before the other one was about to.
Yeah, and if war is characterized in that way, it does take a lot of the allure out of it. It does make it much less glamorous than these, you know, decisive engagements and all that, these you know, quick knockout punches.
And it makes us think about soldiers differently, and I think that's why people resist what I'm saying, is because they think, well, if it's about attrition, isn't that awful? Isn't that morally repugnant? And no government's going to turn to its young men and nowadays also young women and say, oh, we need you to go out there and be part of a war of attrition. It's going to say, go out there and win, defeat the enemy because of your moral superiority and your great character, and you're the best that our nation has to offer. And we say all those things, and by the way, everybody says all those things. But in fact, we're sending them out to die in wars of attrition.
Why is it that with sparkling water, I'm always playing guessing games with what flavor I'm drinking? Is it citrus? Is it aluminum can flavored? Not sure. Sparkling ice, though, they really mean flavor. Like in-your-face flavor. Orange mango, black raspberry. Don't even get me started on the strawberry lemonade. Kiwi strawberry slid right into my taste buds' DMs last night and let them know who's boss. No subtleties there and no sugar either. But it does have vitamins and antioxidants. Find sparkling ice at a major grocery store or club retailer near you. Sparkling ice. Anything but subtle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, as you said before, it seems that relatively smaller powers with, you know, less resources and manpower to draw from often seem to be particularly prone to the short war delusion. Although it seems like there are also a fair number of examples of powers that, at least on paper, are overwhelmingly favored on the tail of the tape.
Mm-hmm.
Also falling for the short war delusion. You know, an example that comes to mind for me is in the run-up to the Iraq War of 2003, a lot of what the Bush administration was telling the public and the media about, you know, how cheap and quick and simple those were sort of the neoconservative types at the time. I mean, it's ludicrous when you go back and look at some of their estimates of like how quickly the war, you know, you just knock out Saddam Hussein and then that'll be that. And
it is. But we also had no idea we'd be in Vietnam for 11 years.
Right.
Or that we'd be in Afghanistan. I mean, Afghanistan, we knocked out the Taliban in what? Weeks? Couple of months? And it's 18 years later. We're still there. 19 years later.
Right. So, yeah, I mean, I guess my point is that even the power that by pretty much all objective metrics should be overwhelmingly considered, you know, the Goliath of the equation, number one, can also be falsely lured by the siren
sure.
call of the short, easy war, and then can still lose. Yeah.
The Russians in Afghanistan are another very recent example of that. Or Saddam Hussein invading Iran, thinking that he was
sure.
going to win very quickly. The examples go on and on. I think we have another example potentially building on the Indian subcontinent. I mean, I hope not, but that one's always festering and ready to go. So, yes, I think this is where things started to get mixed up a little, though, because in addition, one of the reasons the people that you're talking about have this illusion is they also have a subordinate illusion, I would say. It's part of the whole package, and that is the idea that technology wins wars. But that's demonstrably not always the case, that if I have the superior technology, then I'm going to win. Really? Why did we lose in Vietnam? Why did the Russians lose in Afghanistan? Why are we losing in Afghanistan now? Because I think we are. It's endurance. It's willpower. And you have to admit these things. You have to back off these nationalist interpretations of war and look at them with a cold and hard eye and realize, I'm sorry, that 17-year-old Taliban up the valley, he's got guts. And his society has an enduring capacity to fight, and he wants you out. And you're not going to, after 18 years, flying overhead with helicopters that he has no chance of shooting down, or very rarely, that's not enough of an intimidation. The war will go on and on and on. We need to change strategy, but we're not.
Yeah, it seems like a common reason. I mean, I guess it's not the, I'm not saying it's the only reason, but part of the reason why there's often this hubris is not taking into account that at the end of the day, whoever your opponent is, even though they may not have as much wealth or technology as you do or something like that, they're still human beings with just as much potential capacity to think and to learn and to adapt as you have.
They're intelligent.
Yeah.
And it's their, and if it's their country that your forces are in, you know, even if they're a nasty part of that country, it's their country, and they're going to be able to sustain the psychological commitment to a grinding war that makes mothers weep on both sides probably longer than you are, unless you're truly, absolutely ruthless and you go in and you exterminate them, which is kind of what the Soviets tried to do, and they still lost. And by the way, you know, I think it has to be fairly said, that's kind of what we were doing at the end of the Vietnam War with these massive retribution bombing campaigns.
Right, yeah.
Who runs Vietnam now?
Right. Yeah, well, is it, how do I phrase the question? Or is it simply, do you think, an inevitable tragic element of history that these sorts of things are going to keep playing out? And because it seems like if you look at war in this way, that all of the allure and the glamour is gone, and it becomes much more of just a tragedy. And you look at all those lives, you know, sacrificed to the hubris of Napoleon or the hubris of the various German leaders of the 20th century or whoever.
But not just the leaders, also their nations. I think the vanity of nations is the problem that we're in, really, even more than the vanity of leaders. But yes, go ahead.
Okay, yeah, excellent point there. I mean, are we just sort of doomed to have these sorts of things periodically keep happening, and all those lives, you know, lost in many instances unnecessarily?
I'm sorry to say that I do think that is the case. That the I think another sort of tertiary argument that you'll see come through in the book is I don't think we learn from history. And as a teacher of history, I'm sometimes not sure what the point is in some ways. We don't learn even from our own history. It's virtually impossible to learn from other people's histories. And I think that what the best we have and why we have these sort of peace breaks out in a kind of surprising way every so often, usually after a really catastrophic series of wars. And I think what explains it is you have generational exhaustion. The generation after the Civil War was exhausted by the notion of war, knew that the acquisition of territory from Mexico had helped provoke it, didn't want anything to do with another war with Spain and Cuba in the 1860s. But a generation then faded, they died, and then the same situation in Cuba comes up in the 1890s and we get the Spanish-American War. So I think you have a generation that knows war, that hates war because they came to know it, that wants to avoid it at almost any cost, that tells its leaders to do so. They do avoid it, and then the generation grows old, grows gray, and dies. And another generation comes along that doesn't know war at all, except it's bookish. It's in the history books. It's not, they don't really know war, and they think they might like to try it. And I do think that pattern has emerged again and again and again. And I say that with no pleasant, pleasure, because we are now at the end of the generation that fought the Second World War. We think we know about the horrors of nuclear war and Hiroshima and Nagasaki, but we don't know it. It's gray and grainy and on the films and it's in the history books, but we don't know it. We don't fear it. We don't fear bombers by thousands coming over the skies of our cities the way they feared it because they did it in the 1940s. We don't fear that. And we have a man in Russia right now, Putin, who didn't fear it, post-World War II generation, born after the war, no memory of it. And he's trying it again.
Yeah, these are, this point about the generations. I've made similar points myself, both on this podcast and to my students in my sort of day job teaching. And I mean, I was hoping maybe you'd be a little bit more optimistic than me, but
I'm an optimist by temperament, but by education and experience as a historian, it's turned me into a pessimist. I hope I'm wrong. I absolutely hope I'm completely and totally wrong. But I see this pattern so many times in history. And it's a pattern, and history doesn't repeat itself, as you know. Mark Twain was right. It doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. And the rhymes are these large patterns where a persistent human nature and a forgetfulness and a generational psychology re-encounters conflict and war with new technologies and new national configurations. But if you walk away from all of that, step back and take the big picture view, it's the same thing. We've been doing it not for hundreds of years. We've been doing it for millennia.
And I wonder if the United States might be, in terms of its current generation of leaders, particularly prone to, I don't know, recklessness or hubris for a variety of reasons, not only because the World War II generation is mostly gone. I mean, when I look back at the Cold War, I go, wow, would we have made it through the Cold War without, you know, the thermonuclear trigger being pulled if it didn't just so happen that the guys who held the helm of power at the time were the World War II, you know, generation, and they had
I think that's a good question. You can't answer it, but it's a good question.
Yeah, I mean, as reckless as some of them could be at times, none of them ever ultimately, you know, launched the nukes during any of the crises.
No, and when MacArthur actually called for nukes to be used against China in the Korean War, Truman fired him.
Right, right. But then the other thing that makes me wonder about the United States in particular is that even when we look back to the last, you know, truly giant war, of course, World War II, virtually none of that directly touched the United States in terms of the homeland. You know, there were no American cities leveled to the ground there, you know, nothing like that.
Five Americans were killed on U.S. mainland soil in Bly, Oregon. That's it, by a Japanese balloon bomb. That's it. A Sunday school party was killed. It was the only Americans killed in the 48 states.
Right, right. So, you know, looking at some of these other countries, I mean, they have the same generational constellation as far as, you know, obviously their World War II veterans are mostly gone as well. But but at least in some of the countries in Europe and Asia, there's at least a little bit more of I guess, a living memory among some of the population, simply because their cities actually did get leveled to the ground. And
I think that's true. Japan, you know, as well. But again, you know, the current prime minister of Japan is attempting to alter the Article 9 of the Constitution to allow Japan to deploy military forces abroad. So is it causing him political trouble? Is he having difficulty doing it? Yes. But that's now another 10 or 15 years. And we'll be even further removed from the Japanese memory of the war. And people will say, well, we need to defend ourselves. Well, why should we be restricted? Why can't we be a normal nation? We're one of the good nations. And they'll change the Constitution. You know, we shall see what happens on the eastern frontier of what is currently the NATO countries, although NATO, it's hard to see it as anything but a shell of an alliance any longer. But we shall see. The Germans, clearly, they absolutely wanted nothing to do with a war, particularly with the Russians, so they're staying out of the Ukrainian conflict and so on. But at the end of the day, that's on their border. It's just across. It's just over there. It's too close. It's too threatening. When Putin goes, what will happen in Russia? Will there be chaos? Will there be more conflict? Will there be another demagogue trying to distract from domestic problems by a war into the Baltic states? Can the Germans ignore that? I am not persuaded that they would not become engaged again. It would be difficult. It would be reluctant. It would be last minute. But it's not impossible.
Yeah, we tragically may yet see more leaders being seduced by the allure of battle then.
And peoples. I mean, look at the Russians today. I mean, I do think this applies. Putin invades Crimea. His polls go into the 90s. Then they start falling back as people realize we're still in Russia, misgoverned kleptocracy. And then he invades Ukraine, and his polls go back up into the high 80s. I mean, it's the oldest trick in the book. The Argentine junta was collapsing from domestic unpopularity and so on, and it invaded the Falkland Islands, as a grand distraction. It's an old autocratic trick. One worries in the news today about this talk about Iran and America clashing. Things can get out of control, and Iran is not a minor power. This is not even Iraq we're talking about. This is a significant power with a big population, a sophisticated, determined culture. People should be very nervous about what is happening there, I think.
Well, before we close off, were there any major points that you wanted to make, or anything about the allure of battle that you wanted to get to that we didn't hit on yet?
Just that I really hope I'm wrong. I really do hope I'm wrong, because it's the next book I'm writing, actually, is my students kind of talked me into doing this. It's called Decency, and I'm looking for sort of, small green shoots of decency in the midst of warfare, because I tend to depress my students a lot. I need to do something, and myself, to be honest. I need to try and find something better. I don't have any larger points about the book. The one thing I would say in its favor, and you sort of mentioned it, is I do think it's well written. I do think it. I tried to do in this book. I tried to say things that I thought. I'm 62 now. I've tried to say things that I've been thinking about all my life, but never really articulated myself, as you were saying earlier in my life. And in the sort of writing of the book, it came together. And then I have to thank my publisher, who just said, go for it. I mean, at one point I had $125,000 word limit, $125,000 word limit. And I was at about 75,000, and I was about a third of the way through, and I said, I can't do it. And he said, we don't care. Just go ahead, write what you want. Which is why it ended up at 800 pages. But that freed me. That freed me to say things that I think are not in a lot of history books. And I am surprised. I had no idea about this book prize. I didn't even know I was on the final committee until I got an email from them. But I'm surprised by the critical reaction. I'm most pleased by the fact that active military read this, and they just go, yep. And it's been well received in the military journals and by active military. And I think, unfortunately, for a sad reason, which is I'm not telling them anything they don't know. They know they're in a war of attrition. In fact, when I asked, I won't say who it was, but I asked an active duty colonel at Fort Leavenworth when I was out there. I was getting briefed on lessons learned from Afghanistan and Iraq. And I, again, too cheekily said for a civilian, have we learned any lessons? And he immediately said, we have. The politicians have not.
Well, on that
sobering note,
sad but true, I guess.
Sort
of note. I do want to urge anyone who's at all interested to go and check out The Allure of Battle. It is a very interesting read. I learned a lot, in addition to also having some of my preconceived thoughts of things bolstered and articulated better with more research than I've ever done on these topics. So thank you very much, Professor Nolan, for taking the time and being on the podcast today.
Thank you for having me.
All right, and I just want to once again thank Professor Nolan for giving me the time to come on the podcast. And like I said, I highly recommend the book, The Allure of Battle. I found it a fascinating read, and I learned a lot of things, and at the same time, it interestingly dovetailed with some of my larger observations and statements over the years regarding military history and the way that battle and warfare and the alleged great captains of war are often romanticized and treated in various ways that are somewhat misleading. So if it's a topic you're all interested in, it is definitely a book worth reading. I'll also link to some of Professor Nolan's other books in the show notes as well, including something I just found out about in our few minutes of chatting before I started recording this podcast conversation. Professor Nolan also writes fiction, future military fiction, kind of sci-fi stuff, written under the pen name Kali Altsoba. Apparently he started doing this initially, anonymously, not revealing his true identity, although now it's public, so I'm okay telling you this. But yeah, I had no idea, and he mentioned it to me when we were chatting. So I'll link to some of those books as well. Looks like interesting stuff. You may want to check it out if that's something you're into. So all that and more, as usual, in the show notes for this episode. Thanks for listening to the Dangerous History Podcast. If you like what you heard, there are many ways you can help the show. One of the most important, of course, is to spread the word about the show to others that you think might appreciate it to help grow the audience. Another huge way is to help out the show financially in some way. There are many ways you can do this. You can make a one-time or recurring donation via PayPal. Or one of the best ways is to sign up to make a recurring contribution to the Dangerous History Podcast via Patreon or Subscribestar. If you sign up for just $5 per month via either Patreon or Subscribestar, you'll get access to exclusive bonus Dangerous History Podcast episodes that are available nowhere else. And you'll also get access to vintage DHP episodes, which are the first 52 episodes of the show, which are no longer available to Gen Pop, the general population. You will also get ad-free versions of regular DHP episodes as they come out. And lastly, for that same contribution, you will also have the option to join the private Facebook group, the Dangerous History Podcast Scholar Warriors. Another great way you can help out the show at no additional cost to you is to do your Amazon shopping through any of my Amazon affiliate links that are found on my website, dangeroushistorypodcast.com. And if you go through those affiliate links to get to Amazon, anything you purchase will, at no additional cost to you, give me a small commission. This is another thing that helps me with things like keeping the lights on for the Dangerous History Podcast, purchasing research materials for upcoming episodes, and so forth. I also have an Amazon wish list full of books and things for future research projects, and so another way you can help me out is buy me something off of that. That's really cool. So anyway, I hope you'll consider contributing or supporting to the show in one way or another to help me keep this thing going and keep this thing constantly growing and improving. This has been another installment of the Dangerous History Podcast. As always, doing my utmost to help you learn the past, understand the present, and prepare for the future.